Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Rasmus Winter about his new book, Our Genes, A Philosophical Perspective on Human Evolutionary Genomics. Rasmus is professor of humanities at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and affiliate professor in the geogenetics section of Globe Institute at the University of Copenhagen. Our Genes is a truly interdisciplinary work that sits at the crossroads of science and philosophy, seeking to answer the fundamental yet elusive question, who are we? Rasmus looks at the history of genomics and proffers an overview of how genes work and what we know about evolution. He also considers the ethical and political dimensions of our study of genes. A wide-ranging book, I'm sure we will not be able to cover everything. If you find this discussion interesting, do check out the book. Rasmus, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Caleb. Much appreciated. It's a pleasure to be here.
Of course. You know this book, you cover so many topics just in this one field. You really delve into genomics from many different aspects. But before talking about the book, I was just wondering if you'd tell us a little about yourself and your background.
I am and have always been a person curious about science and how the world works, and very curious about why the world is structured the way it is and what is going on in the world. I have Danish parents but grew up in South America, in Venezuela, in Caracas. So I grew up speaking Spanish and Danish as my first two languages. And then I went to international school. So that's where I learned my English. And then I came to the US for college, I guess at Stanford University. And then I have worked in Mexico City at the UNAM and in the US, now at UC Santa Cruz, and also honored to be an affiliate professor at the geogenetics section at the Globe Institute. What one can maybe see from these affiliations is also kind of an overlap across disciplinary obsession almost with science and society, the theoretical foundations of scientific theories, conceptual foundations of science, and especially biological science, population genetics, and ecology. I'm also very interested in ecology, although I've published much less on it. That's something I hope to change.
So as far as this particular book is concerned, I'm wondering how you first came to write it. Was there a moment where the idea started to crystallize?
Two things. One was my time at Stanford. I remember I was a philosophy major, but I also took a lot of biology classes. And there were particularly classes with Mark Feldman, who's a pretty well-known geneticist there. He's co-published articles with Richard Lewontin and many others, and has mentored one impressive student after the next. I knew Sally Otto at the time. I can mention Noah Rosenberg, others. And I also took classes with Joan Roughgarden, an ecologist, and I thought she was incredibly interesting too. And there, my love for population genetics, I was always fascinated by Darwin even as a kid, I remember. And I grew up in a tropical country, so there were all kinds of spiders and snakes, and I had praying mantises. I had three aquaria turtles in my room in high school, etc. So always nature. I was obsessed with nature, but it was really population genetics at Stanford that I realized, wow, there really is a theory behind all this. And it's very formal, and there's all these concepts, and it has a deep history. I mean, Darwin obviously is, you might call him one of the, he's the father, sure, of evolutionary the theory of evolution. I mean, we could talk hours about this, but then it also in the 20th century is when it gets formalized by Wright, Fisher, and Haldane, among others. And there's a whole complex story to be told there, which you'll probably ask me about in a minute. But so that's where I fell in love with population genetics. Now, second moment, Carlos Lopez Beltran, a friend and colleague in Mexico City, I remember explicitly when I taught there for 4 years, and it was a wonderful experience. And he's still a great friend and interlocutor. And he said to me one day, he came up to me and he says, "Hey, I'm organizing this group." I mean, it was in Spanish, obviously, we were doing the discussion, we were talking. "Hey, I'm doing this group on critical genomics of race. Would you like to join?" And I thought, well, let's see. I'm not quite sure what critical genomics of race is, but that's where the conversation started. And that group has had a lot of sort of early impact on why is it even interesting to think about reifying race, and is race, is it even a valid biological category, and this and that. And I started remembering, you know, reading my way through Lewontin 72, his famous piece, Apportionment of Human Diversity, when I was an undergrad. And that's a second moment. And the third moment is my co-authorship with Jonathan Kaplan, who is a professor at Ohio State University, a good friend. And we wrote three papers together, and two of those papers, maybe all three, all three somehow serve as early points of departure for some of the chapters. But I rearranged everything. I rewrote this book from scratch. I mean, I took some. So how did it crystallize? Well, I took some of those papers. I wrote new, like chapter two is completely new. Chapter seven on natural selection is completely new. The introduction is completely new, et cetera. I didn't just collect papers, but I collected themes and the relation, you know, population genetics as a theory, the very problematic of race, the controversial topic. And then things like natural selection in the human population, what are signatures and where can we see natural selection? So I know that's a long-winded answer, but it's really a mix of my time at Stanford early in my undergraduate years, learning about population genetics, my time in Mexico City, critical genomics of race under the leadership of Carlos Lopez, and my co-authorships of three papers with Jonathan Kaplan. Those are really kind of the precursors to the book. And then just being fascinated and obsessed with the social context of science and Darwinism. Thanks.
It's undeniable that you've been working on this in a sense that maybe the actual writing itself, you know, wasn't all the time that you spent working on it, but that you really spent a decent portion of your career working on this, or at least on the ideas that you present in the book. You know, I want to assume that people listening to this might not themselves be experts on the topic. So, you know, just starting from the most basic level, just to get some grounding, some footing, can you just tell us what genes are and why someone interested in politics or philosophy should care about them?
The reason this is important is because there's some kind of idea that genes, or what is inside of us, or what we've inherited from our ancestors, will determine, maybe almost fatalistically, who we are, what we do, etc. Now, this is a well-worn theme. But then the question is, we're not just our genes, we're also our environment and our culture. This, of course, is, you know, the so-called nature-nurture debate slash wars. These are, again, well-worn themes, but this is why we probably should care about what do genes do, and how under evolution for thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, what has happened to the human career? What has happened to humanity over that time? And what has happened to other species? And what happens in other species? And the reason we do care about this is we see difference and similarities. Genes give us both differences and similarities. And somehow they came to underlie, I think, with some justification, but not definitely not totally, they came to underlie our judgments of how we divide up humans into groups, into subgroups, etc. And sure, humans, I don't know how much you want, maybe not sure how much you want me to get into this right now. We're a single species, but there is some truth to the fact that, you know, we originated, depends how you count and depends where you set the species line, maybe 300,000 years ago, some might say is when modern Homo sapiens or 250K modern Homo sapiens proper emerged. We probably split, or our ancestry split with Neanderthals maybe 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 years ago. Look, there's a lot of debate about this. But are Neanderthals humans? Are Denisovans humans? These are questions that geneticists will ask. And so we have to think not just of the structure within our species, but also where does our species end? And so genetics can help us look at many of these questions about in-groups and out-groups, about similarities and differences, and how similar are you, me and you? And if we learn something about your physiology, does it tell me something about my physiology, and vice versa? And what if it was a random person we just chose from the streets of New York, or where I think you're in New York? And right now I'm sitting in San Francisco, but what about we're sitting in Jakarta, which I sometimes am, et cetera. So yeah, I think I'll stop there. I really could go on, but I feel I should stop there.
Yeah, I think this is obviously, and I think maybe this is part of the difficulty in even broaching the subject, is that it's a very fraught field in a certain way. The discussion of genomics, especially as it relates to politics, mm-hmm. and society, because of the potential implications and also the history that people have used genes and quote unquote genetic difference as a basis for oppressing people and for pointing out difference where it might not actually be significant. So you make the claim that genomics is not a good basis for arguing about human rights. And why do you make this claim? And if you could just address a little bit about the fraught nature of this debate.
Great. In the book, I make a distinction. I make a thought experiment. Is the human species more like what I call planet unity? I don't want to go into the details, though listeners are welcome to look at the book, to read that part of the book. It's very early on. It's already in the second chapter. Are we more like planet unity, where everyone is basically the same? And I have this little bit of an elaborate science fiction story of it. Or are we what I call Galapagos writ large? This is like where you would have like think of the finches or the tortoises on the Galapagos Island, spread them out. And think if you put proto-humans in the Galapagos and spread out the island so that they were totally, you couldn't reach one from the other, and then spun the tape of life of human evolution 10 millions of years, humans would evolve into different species. It's undeniable. I mean, that's basic evolutionary theory. And then, you know, we could ask on Galapagos writ large, are they now the same? How similar are the species, et cetera? And so I asked, where are we? Homo sapiens 2024 are... how much closer are we to planet unity than to the Galapagos writ large? Where along this spectrum are we? And yeah, I mean, I think many listeners would immediately say, hey, we're much closer to planet unity, but how much closer? So is race a category, a valid category? And yes, you have to talk about different social contexts of race across the globe, but is our populations... I mean, is Icelanders and Danes and Germans, is that in any way a valid category? But what, when is a human population a valid human population? These are questions that I get into. And then you ask me, this is a very fraught.
Yeah, it's politically fraught because it's loaded. The suggestion that if there are differences between populations, that this could be a basis, you know, that people have in the past used that as a basis for creating unequal political social right. orders. So that's, I think, the fraughtness of it, is that if I think part of the reason that people are frightened about the field of genomics, or why they don't want to deal with it, because of the potential political implications. And you make the claim that it's still worth studying this field, and that it's not that even if we discover certain differences between populations or individuals, that it's not a basis for it shouldn't be a basis for determining human rights or who should be considered human in that sense.
So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read a couple sentences from the book. The genome neither proves human equality nor demonstrates human hierarchy. These contingencies should underscore the importance of learning some of the details of human genomics. We must learn so as to begin to understand the simultaneous power and limits of science, especially with respect to complex social and ecological systems. I could keep on reading. This is on page 16, but let me switch from reading to explaining a bit more. To make a long story short, this book, if I may, I think falls somewhere in between two political interpretations today. One is I'm going to call it another peer of mine that I am co-authoring an article with, but he likes to call it the standard liberal consensus. I think I call it the liberal consensus. Yes, he calls it the standard liberal critique of race. A lot of that has truth to it. Let me underscore that. A lot of the standard liberal critique, I'm thinking of people like Adam Rutherford, who's a geneticist. Spencer Wells is a little more. Jonathan Marks is another person. Let me be clear. I have high respect for them, but I think they overstate the case. And this is tricky itself to say, but if you really stare the genetic facts in the face, I think it's hard to read a complete absence of any kind, not only of population structure, but of what might be called population of population structure. Let's not call it a racial structure, but let's call it a kind of meta population structure. It's not a lot, but it's some. But it's certainly not as much as people most famously or infamously, if you will, that someone like Charles Murray wants to make. I know he's most infamous for his bell curve book. He has a much more recent book called Human Diversity, where he discusses many of these issues. And I think it's pretty clear that he has at least a reasonable understanding of a lot of the genetics. And my book is trying to make sense simultaneously of, well, it's trying to make sense ultimately of the data and of the theory. And I think, and I've been told by several geneticists, I won't mention names, but you can look at the blurbs on the back of the book and others, whose names I won't repeat here because maybe they prefer to stay anonymous, that my book is probably the one that does the best, sorry for saying, but it's probably the one that does the best job at being fair to the theory and data. Jonathan Marks on the left, Charles Murray on the right, both overstate the case. Having said this, yes, I think reality is closer to Jonathan Marks's view than Charles Murray's view, but it is more complex. Now, I actually then make a surprising switch or move, I think, to many. I just say we shouldn't care. In the end, let me be very specific. We shouldn't care about what the genetics tells us. We should still learn some genetics so we even know what we're talking about. And so for the context where genetics does make a difference, we know what we're talking about in the theory and in the data. But what we shouldn't care about is why base any kind of morality and any kind of how we treat one another in the social contract, why base that on maybe partly true, but ambiguous and changing over time interpretations about differences, innate, if you will, innate genetic differences among people? And it needn't just be among big groups of people. It can even be among, you know, people of the same group. Me and some of the people in my lineage or whatever. So that's in a way the take home message of the book. And I know it sounds a little paradoxical, but the take home message, I'm not going to read because I could read, but you can look at it on page 16 and 17, that we should base, it's ethical legal, moral, empathetic, sentimental considerations that should tell us how we should build a social contract. It's not the science that should tell us how to build the social contract.
I think it's an extremely important case. I mean, you know, one of the ways that I think about it is, and tell me if this is part of the way in which you might think about it, is like, for example, like I kind of regret doing it. I did one of the 23andMe tests, and now apparently there's been major hacks. So all of my personal data is somewhere floating out there in the universe. But part of the reason why I was curious to do it is because, you know, I'm on both sides of my family. I'm Ashkenazi Jewish, and I know that can predispose one to certain genetic illnesses. So I was curious to see if I had any genetic predispositions to illness, and that was the reason why I was interested. It wasn't to. I don't think I would conclude, oh no, I have this predisposition towards, might be a carrier of Tay-Sachs or something like that. That therefore means that my value as a human or my human rights should be not considered. It's more so about it's good to know this information, right? Because it could be valuable for my own personal health. And that's how I think about it. It's like, that's the value. The ultimate value of this is that people should know what their health outcomes are so that they can then take action in actionable ways. I don't know if that's sort of one of the ways in which you might think about it, sort of a use case.
100%. Couldn't agree more. And I think that's what's very... thank you. I mean, you're a very good interviewer, because you're segueing me subtly without really directly asking a question. So thank you for that. What I've talked about the last 10 minutes is it comes from a place of obsession with the race question and with the hierarchy question, et cetera. But let's look at other applications, as I try to do in the book, of so many other places where population genetics, where human evolutionary genomics, which is a subset of the larger field of population genetics, let's look at other places where it touches applications. So absolutely, personalized medicine, and you know, that's something I spend a good amount of time on in chapter 8, I believe it is. And there's some stuff on medicine there. Yeah, absolutely. And chapter 8, that's a use case, to use your term, where... ancestry studies, population genomics is relevant. That's another place where it would behoove people, I think, to understand some of the details of what are the modeling methodologies that are being used here. How is ancestry defined? What are the populations, the basic units from, I mean, you talk about Ashkenazi Jews. Is that a reasonable population from a scientific point of view? There's a lot of literature on this, and I try to get into this, or at least ask these questions. Is Han Chinese the same kind of population, you know, with orders of magnitude more people than Ashkenazi Jew? And are there biases in sampling and procedures for measurement when you are dealing with populations as different in, say, even just something as basic as population size between an Ashkenazi Jew on the one hand, Han Chinese on the other? These, I think, are important questions. And so when people understand even the basics of how, what is being measured when you do an, what have companies like 23andMe, which test did you use? Sorry.
Yeah, I used 23andMe.
Okay, right. So I thought that's the one you said. When companies like 23andMe do these studies, what are they based on? What have they measured? What populations have they measured, and what have they measured about them? And then once they had that data, how do they feed them into the machine, the computational mathematical modeling machine, to get out some predictions or some patterns of these different populations? And then what happens when they, how do they deal with the customers? What is it about when the customers send in their spit, saliva, et cetera, what is it that they do to that data? Not just, there's both the question, what do they do with it downstream? Do they talk to the FBI? Do they talk with law enforcement agency, local police, et cetera? But before that, how do they when they sequence your DNA, what do they do? What do they do compared to their mathematical models to tell maybe you that you're 90, I don't know, I don't know if you want to share, but I'm just hypothetically, let's say that you got back that you were 97% Ashkenazi Jew or something. And then what does that mean? What's 97%? What if you were 85%? All that is discussed. That is discussed in the book.
Right. And then obviously there can also be, you know, the differences can be life or death between even siblings or cousins, yes, even if they share.
Correct.
So it's like at a certain point, yeah, what is a population measuring if there could be major differences between family members? I think there's, you know, we'll have more to get into in terms of the kind of contemporary research around it. But I think it's also important for people to understand a little bit about the origins and early history of the field of genomics. So can you talk about when the genetic paradigm first emerged? Obviously, you mentioned Galapagos. Can you talk a little bit about the early history?
Yes, I'll try to be as brief as I possibly can. Darwin is obviously important here. Darwin was important because, you know, he set up the very, I mean, he kind of framed the whole, he set up the whole stage, as it were, that there was descent with modification, to use his term. That means that all life has a common ancestry, and this happens in a branching way. And yes, you can have debates about whether there's merging of the branches and symbiosis, et cetera. These are extremely important debates. I get a little bit into that too. But you're asking me about the early history. Darwin really focused on the branching of the tree of life. And he focused on one particular mechanism for evolution to happen, and that was natural selection. He accepted there were other mechanisms, but that's the one we've all learned about, and that's probably the one that's most familiar, as you point out to me in our conversations earlier, that's probably familiar to many readers. Darwin is absolutely a part of the prehistory, but he didn't know squat about genetics. One of my first single authored paper, and it actually makes it into a movie in a documentary, was very something about a boy, Aaron Schwartz, unfortunately, who committed suicide. But there's a part in the movie where they talk about the knowledge of humanity, and I watched this movie, and it was so bizarre to see my paper, Darwin on Variation and Heredity, being singled out as the example of the knowledge of humanity, and how the global South people in India, that I'm taking literal words from that movie, people in India and the global South should have access to all human knowledge. And then for some bizarre reason, Darwin on Variation and Heredity, which is my first solo authored paper, is put up as a paradigm. Darwin believed something called pangenesis. He thought every part of the body gave up these, what he called gemmules, that were collected in the ovaries or the testicles. And then this is Lamarckism. Darwin was a Lamarckian when it came to inheritance. That's another rabbit path I don't want to go down. But the person who kind of started nailing it in Darwin's time, a contemporary of Darwin, was obviously Mendel. We've done Punnett squares, dominant and recessive, which my friend and colleague Greg Raddick has a book kind of taking issue with the very idea of dominance and recessives. But I take issue with some of Greg's, but, you know, that's all part of academia and intellectual life. So the 19th century set the stage with the evolutionary theory of Darwin and the genetics, early genetics. Mendel never used that term, but Mendel's views. And then that really reemerges or starting to get synthesized in the early 20th century. And I'm going to have to skip over too much history, but in a way, the three people who do that, and I know this is a little bit textbook history, but it's J.B.S. Haldane, Sewell Wright, and R.A. Fisher who really do that melding. And people these days, for I think reasonable reasons, but also it's a complicated story. They're not, R.A. Fisher has lost a lot of street cred, shall we say, and that might be an understatement. But like it or not, he was pretty important. You can't really tell the history of 20th century statistics without R.A. Fisher. But yes, he was, and I acknowledge that, and I say it clearly, loud and clearly in the book. He was worrisomely interested in selective breeding, et cetera. That's a different conversation. But he was really interesting because he tied statistics and genetics together. Because he saw, like, think of what stats is. You need a population with many individuals where each individual can take on different different values, say different values of height if we have a continuous measurement, or male-female if we're doing discontinuous stats. And genetics gives that exact ideal condition. You have many loci, where so many genes, where and each place on the chromosome, I'm over-exaggerating, or each genetic locus, as it's called, can take on different values. And so Fisher really, I'm saying it too simply, but Fisher really milked that analogy. It's not even an analogy, it's a use case of stats. And in the second chapter of the book, I say in a way that Fisher probably is among the most important in nailing the genetic paradigm, because he ties it to the origin of modern statistics also. That just like you can have many loci, each can take on different values. And then you can ask what happens over time when you have many individuals, each with their own genome, and you have selection happening in that population, or you have genetic drift happening in that population. Well, that gives rise to statistics too, Fisherian stats. And yes, and there's a lot more complexity after that.
Something that you talk about in the book is how geneticists tend to think in terms of populations. Mm-hmm. We've kind of used that term populations a little bit, but I think it's important to define, what is meant exactly by populations in the study of genomics. And you've already gotten into a little bit of the advantages or maybe pitfalls of this frame, but how would you define populations, and why is this kind of seen as a very crucial unit for geneticists?
Let's not forget that the field, one of three names for the field is population genetics. Another name is evolutionary genetics. Then more modern, also evolutionary genomics. But why is it called population genetics, and what is a population, as you ask? Population is some kind of constellation or group of individuals that, under assumption, have pretty much or very close to random mating among one another, and that they somehow reproduce with one another. And there's a much higher tendency for individuals within a population to reproduce with one another and have offspring, as opposed to any one of them reproducing or having offspring with someone from another population or some unit from another population. So a population is kind of a natural unit. What's interesting, it's also a natural unit in statistics. We talk about populations and samples in statistics. Population, and then we talk about theoretical populations and actual samples in statistics. And the theoretical population is the one that's governed by whatever your probability distribution function. It's the one that you are it's the one you want to know something about, but you don't have direct access to. You might wonder, wait, population, the same word is used both in stats and in genetics. Well, it's not surprising, and I hate to say it, but it's R.A. Fisher. And he wrote an extremely influential paper in the 1920s that set a lot of the vocabulary for both genetics and statistics. The title is On the Mathematical Foundation of Theoretical Statistics. And that's a paper from 1922. Read this today. A lot of it is bizarre and kind of outdated. I have high-level statistician friends I've told, hey, what do you think about this paper? But then they also say, man, but he set the vocabulary. I mean, there's so much of the vocabulary. So in genetics and population genetics, we would call that, I call that a theoretical population. That's like a population, in your idealized models, that's a population that you set into your computer, or you assume in your mathematical derivations. Then there's also what I call a laboratory population. A laboratory population is one where you're in the lab or you have like a group of mice, or I'm thinking of one of my grad school mentors, Michael Wade, very famous for group selection ideas. So selection, he thinks he has very good arguments for it, and we've published together that selection doesn't only happen at the individual level, like the standard Darwinian story, but it happens at higher levels too. That is, populations can actually compete with one another. We know it from ant colonies and bees, right? I mean, colonies compete with one another. Well, why not say, I mean, isn't there something about closely related populations, families, et cetera, also competing with one another? Eliot Sober is a well-known philosopher who has written a lot about this, and I really like Eliot's work. I think it's about the best there is. Introducing the formal theory, or thinking about the philosophical theories behind the formal theory. Well, his and my work are the two best work. Let's put it that way on doing that. So, and then the last, so that's a laboratory population is what you set up in the lab. And Mike Wade has done that with flower beetles. He set up thousands and tens of thousands of individuals and populations in his career in the lab, and see what dynamics happen when you select both at the vial level. Each vial you can think of as one population, which has a bunch of flower beetles in it. And the relation between individual and group selection. That you can do in the lab. And then there's what I call natural populations. That's what an ecologist goes out and measures. In this time of, you know, tragic, and I think about it every single day, ecological loss and biodiversity loss, not just climate change, but biodiversity loss. I think that's to my mind, that's the real killer. We need to care about, it's not just about extinction of species, but it's loss of sheer populations. It's something like we've lost 90% of all individual animals on the planet in the last 50 years. It's not that we've lost 90% of all species. There's still a lot of species. And I know this might sound paradoxical, but we haven't actually lost that many species. Yes, the extinction rate is higher due to anthropogenic causes than the background extinction rate. It is higher. But what is more worrisome is the extinctions to come because of the loss of natural populations, overfishing, deforestation. There's still a lot of species, individuals of each species all over the ocean, different parts of the oceans or different part of the Amazon rainforest, but there's much fewer of them. And a species becomes much less robust when it loses natural populations. So in the book, in chapter 3, I discuss theoretical, laboratory, and natural populations.
And when it comes to these populations, you know, what are some of the tools that we use to measure genetic variation?
So that's in chapter 4. And I accept, and I say in the introduction, that chapters 4 and 5 are the most technically challenging. But let me try to say it at a very high level. Let's just return to the fact that in a way, this is a love letter to population genetics, which I frankly think doesn't get enough love for many reasons that, you know, might be too. For example, people are very excited about epigenetics. I get it. Epigenetics is very interesting, but you know, people are excited about what the so-called extended evolutionary synthesis. But I think a lot of that is they're add-ons. They're interesting and important add-ons, but maybe I'm old-fashioned. I still think population genetics and evolutionary genetics are kind of one theoretical core for evolutionary theory. But you know, that would take us a little bit afield, but I mentioned that in the first chapter. But returning, if we're talking about population genetics, then we need to ask things like, what is it one wishes to measure? Science always asks, empirical science, not formal mathematics or maybe most abstract levels of theoretical physics, always asks, what should we measure? And then how should we analyze those measurements with some kind of mathematical model or some kind of tool? It could be a visual model too, some kind of tool that gives us an understanding of the data. So in chapter three, I talk about different measures of variation. Genetic variation is a very key, it's difference. There's so much difference, but maybe there's not. We're also a species that where everyone is actually mostly the same. We all share, we can have long discussions about the exact number and what it means, but we're basically identical at something like 99% of our genome. It's, some will say it's more than that, some will say it's less. It's probably even more than that. But that means you and I and everyone else, everyone listening to this, have exactly the same letter, base pair, ACTG, at 99%+ of our genome. So we're all basically identical. But where the action lies evolutionarily is, where are we different? Where is there variation in the population? And chapter four spends a lot of time thinking about what are different conceptualizations of how we measure that variation. And without going into details, I'm just going to say I talk about genetic diversity, heterozygosity, which is a technical term, and genetic differentiation. And I talk about how they're used in different contexts. Genetic differentiation is really important when you're doing trees, when you want to build phylogenies, how different species or different populations are from each other. And if you want to try to maybe make inferences about human migration patterns in the past or something like that. But I admit that chapter four is somewhat technical. But look, let me just make a footnote here. We need to be curious and have some knowledge about core theory. And I'm always kind of a little bit amazed how my philosopher of physics friends know way more about core physics relatively than my, pardon, sorry for saying it, but than my philosopher of biology friends. It just, there's very few people who really take the time and energy and philosophy of biology to really understand core evolutionary theory. And I think it's a little bit of a disservice because it shorts philosophy of biology. And maybe, I'm just going to come out right and say it. We might take a leaf from the page of philosophy of physics, which is a lot more interested in quantum mechanics and string theory, et cetera. And that's what, so chapter four, even though it's technical, I recommend it to, especially maybe to philosopher students in philosophy of biology. And should I talk about chapter five? Well, sorry.
Sure, yeah, go for it. Yeah, the different ways we measure and model populations. Yeah.
So it's about measuring and modeling populations. So there's, look, I'm what in philosophy of science is called a pluralist. And I think, you know, anyone who looks at this has almost got to be a pluralist, that there are many measures and each is trying to answer particular questions and look at and measuring particular things. I mean, again, there are technical differences in definition between genetic diversity, heterozygosity, and genetic differentiation. But then once we have all this data, what do we do with it? So that's where the mathematical modeling, and that's chapter five, that's where that comes in. And I do on occasion say to the students too, in the interest of time, let me just say that you, because I do think this will take us a little bit afield, I just look at two big families of models that are used, what I call variance partitioning, and what is called, but I also call it, clustering analysis, to look at, these are two, I think they're asking different questions and they're consistent with one another. I'm hardly the first person to say that. Lewontin and Feldman said that in a paper in 2008. Noah Rosenberg said it in one of the papers to a volume I have, Collected Papers of Anthony Edwards, that appeared in 2018. Other people have said it, but I do think there's some a so-called Lewontin's fallacy. And it's not a fallacy. I mean, Edwards overstated the case. there. I mean, Lewontin was interested in a certain type of question, and Edwards was interested in another type of question. Very roughly, Lewontin was interested in what's called variance partitioning. Edwards is interested in what's called clustering, or is there structure? In long story short, look, almost all variation is among individuals within small populations. All something like 86, using Lewontin statistics from 72, 86% of all variation is among individuals within small populations. It's among individuals, Icelanders, Germans, Han Chinese, Ashkenazi Jews, etc. Almost, you are almost as different from your cousin as you are to me or a random person off the street. Maybe not your first cousin, but it doesn't take very far out in the family, but it could, it's pretty damn close even with your first cousin. But look up Graham Koop's work at UC Davis. He's better at these things than I am. He's a biologist. So that's what variance partitioning is interested in. These different levels of variance, what Lewontin called races or populations of populations, populations and individuals. Variance partitioning is interested in asking, in the human species, how much genetic variation is among individuals within populations, is among populations, and is among populations of populations or races. The short answer is 80, Lewontin stats, 86%, 7%, 7%. I recalculated Lewontin from scratch. He got every gene wrong except one, but very little mistakes. And look, the guy was, I mean, he was a genius. I mean, and he was doing this with a slide ruler and with a calculator. I could use Excel and Mathematica, et cetera. So that's variance partition. Structuring analysis then says, look, even if there's a tiniest amount of difference among populations or among populations and populations for any one gene, what if I looked at many genes? And by the time you get to 20 or 30 genes with the kind of variance diversity structure that Lewontin found, which I call Lewontin's distribution, you just need 20 or 30. By the time you get to 30 genes, information for 30 genes, I can almost with certainty tell you, given that I already tell you what populations are, including Ashkenazi Jews, Caleb, you fit within Ashkenazi Jews. That's the structure program. It's an algorithm that was developed by Jonathan Pritchard and others at Stanford at the time. Those are two models of what to do with human genetic diversity, and they ask very different questions, but they're totally consistent. It's true that there's very little among population and among populations of populations genetic variation in humans. But even with very little, as long as you look at many genes, you can tell where you can classify where any individual is from with high levels of certainty.
Thank you. What are some of the major empirical patterns of human genetic variation now that you sort of established that? Are there some interesting patterns that you think that you discuss in the book?
Well, first, that let's remember. Right as Peter Godfrey Smith, who was my advisor as an undergraduate, he used to say, tattoo it in your inner eyelid. That was one, he told me to be clear in my writing, which I was totally reasonable. I learned a lot from him. And he said, you should tattoo it in your inner eyelid. And what I will say to tattoo in the listener's inner eyelid is that we're all basically the same. I mean, genetically, we're an extremely identical species. Why? Because of the 8 billion people, that's an explosion from very small initial population sizes. Yes, over hundreds and thousands of years, but not over that many years. And so again, we're a pretty there's not a lot of intra-specific variation. That's a technical term. Other species have a lot more, especially many plants have way more variation among individuals within a species. We're actually a pretty boring species, meaning we don't have a lot of variation among ourselves, even though we may think we do. And so that's one pattern. Another interesting pattern, in the interest of time, one that I think I should jump to immediately, is by far most genetic variation is on in within and among populations on the African continent. Let me also iterate that very strongly, that most genetic variation is in Africa. This is not surprising. Humans evolved in Africa. And then something like, 60 to 80,000 or whatever, depends on whether you're talking first wave, second wave, migrated out of Africa. But lest it's not obvious to some listener, all humans on this planet are either direct ancestor, well, are some kind of ancestor of an original populations in Africa that either stayed in Africa, moved south, moved west. Let's not forget that Africa is huge, second largest continent after Asia. So, fun fact, people also forget that, and then moved northeast out of Africa and populated the rest of the globe in waves and at different times. And one of the plates, which I actually spend a lot of time on, plate 2.3, kind of summarizes these migrations, et cetera.
So with this discussion of genomics, looking at the history, looking at sort of the ways in which populations are studied, and, I think you're very, very forceful and I think powerful argument about why the differences that we might see are not do not give reason to believe in some of the more historical and with the case of Charles Murray, some contemporary racist interpretations of genomics and genetic difference. I think one of the questions that people just constantly have, it's a ceaseless raging debate, is just the nature versus nurture debate. And what does human evolutionary genomics tell us about the impact of genes versus environment? For example, someone with a particular genetic genetic profile living in one area versus living in another, living in a hot climate versus a warm climate. How much does the surrounding location that one's in, how much does one's parents, how much does one's community make a difference in terms of how their genes might express?
So thank you for the question. Let me make a plea again for learning some of the theory. So even if the listener doesn't read my book or even buy my book or whatever, at least, I don't know, go to Wikipedia, go to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, go to some of these resources to look at what population genetics is about, to answer a question like that. Now, the nature-nurture debate, I think it was Galton who coined it, but I'm wondering, I think he called it a nice jingle of words or something like that. And I think it is kind of like a meme, just like the very title of Dawkins's 1976 book, a title I will not repeat here. I'll leave it to the listener to either remember or to look up. That title is a meme also. It sears itself into your brain to be there forever. Nature nurture, it's almost a question that's either trivial or nonsensical. Of course you need nature and nurture. And there's a gazillion people who have said this forever. Even Galton said it when he wrote the very damn distinction. So what can we do? Well, we can take a Lewontonian route. Lewontin, Richard Lewontin, a hero of mine, I think a hero of probably many listeners, but also, he was... And, sadly, he passed away a few years ago. Very, very brilliant person in so many ways. I wrote an obituary in Science for the People for Lewontin, which I've also gotten people come out of the woodwork saying that they've enjoyed reading that. And it's kind of both an emotional but also technical. And it's called the Master Dialectician.
I think having someone write a technical obituary is one of the highest forms of praise.
Well, go and read it. I mean, I look at three different ways that Lewontin just set the frame for the whole debate. I mean, that's kind of, he was a master at saying, well, things could be this way or that way. So like there could be group select, I'm sorry, there could only be individual level selection, but there can also be levels of selection. And so many of these contrasts that we have in evolutionary theory, Lewontin really kind of reframed it. And he reframed nature nurture. Why? By saying, but of course both are true. And, you know, he talks about the triple helix, title of one of his books. And it's always intertwined, etc. Okay, fine. But then one can ask Dick, all right, Dick, but what does that mean? And so I think another way to deal with the nature nurture is you need to do it on a case by case. But we need, I don't have the answer. We need to just, I think we have to rethink it from the bottom up. And I don't, I give some hints in the book, in chapter 10, especially. I don't really know how to do it. But I think we're still waiting. but it's not going to help to write yet another book about how it's always nature and nurture, or yet another book, you know, that there's interactive effects. I mean, of course there is. Or maybe we just need to give it up. But maybe it's like that meme or that, you know, that unmentionable title from 1976 that just is seared into our minds so that we can't let go of it. I'm not sure.
It might be the case. I think it's the type of question that transfixed me when I was 6 or 7 years old. You know, moving into the realm of more philosophical speculation, which I do appreciate. You know, what does evolutionary genomics tell us about how we can think about things beyond genetics? Think about, you know, let's go for it, the nature of the universe.
Right. Thank you. That's actually a great question. I mean, that is a really great question. And I'd like, just read three sentences here. This is now from page 311. Although it may be a cliche, this is true. All of life is connected. This is not a trivial point. Whether there is a single last common ancestor, or perhaps a network or community of primordial cells that then crisscrossed and networked up through the immense branching tree of life, the historical connection of all life is undeniable. That's one thing I think, and I stop reading there. That's one thing I think we can learn and from genetics. And I think there's just something very beautiful. And also, like, if you look at coalescent theory, first time I mentioned it in today's, coalescent theory is kind of a subdivision or an area of population genetics. And it's about how can we make inferences about how different alleles of the same gene must have come from the same original Ua allele. And actually, that's what the cover of the book is, my visual interpretation of coalescence for four different genes, each with their own alleles. So that's one thing we can learn. And I think there's something really deep and very true. And it's also kind of beautiful to think about the link between evolutionary theory and ecological theory. That's one thing we can learn. Another thing we can learn is kind of genetics becomes one part of the questions of who I am, who you are, who we are, and who are we in relation to each other and to where we're going. I'm paraphrasing from page 313. Genetics is... it's also a little bit undeniable that genetics, or at least your ancestry or your lineage, must be part of the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we've learned. Now, maybe it's all social and maybe all these stories are just cultural. But again, cultural and genetics, or cultural and lineage, have to intertwine. So, and I do end with a paradox in the book, that genes are informative. They're highly informative, like you point out. They can tell us something about our predispositions, especially physiological ones, but maybe also cognitive ones to be discussed, to be thought. I mean, I think increasingly, for better or worse, there is pretty good evidence that just like our bodies are partly shaped by genes, yeah, for better or worse, sorry, guys, our minds are also to an extent, But again, why should that, just note, why should that matter to that should not play a role in our politics. That's what I keep on saying in the book. But the final paradox is that genes are highly informative and they're not at all informative. So, but that doesn't mean, again, we shouldn't learn about genetics, but it's just, maybe it's not, it won't be like, maybe, I don't know, quantum mechanics or, you know, inflation in the Big Bang, et cetera. Maybe that is fundamental. Is genetics fundamental? I think it's fundamental to who we are. It's also fundamental, but up, only up to, God, it's hard. Only up to a point. Let me put it differently. I think you probably could do philosophy without genetics. Can you do philosophy without, say, cognitive science or something about like how our minds works? Maybe not. But I could be, I hope I'm wrong about this, but I still find genetics independently interesting. But it's just that you were asking me philosophically, what can we learn from genetics? And I still think we can learn a lot. I happen to be independently interested in it, but is it absolutely necessary to understanding the universe? If by universe we mean something like life, and we mean something like reproduction, life making more life, then genes are fundamental. If we only mean things like mind, mind emerges, can emerge out of life, but as we're increasingly finding, maybe mind can also emerge out of machines and out of AI, et cetera. And then genetics has lost its monopoly on consciousness, as it were. And that's another thing to think about.
Yeah, I certainly think, you know, some of the findings just from genetic research, for me, the fact of just how genetics tells us that we all come from the same ancestor at some point, or even true for different species. That alone, I think, is just an incredible revelation. And the ability also to, you know, not like we need that much proof to demonstrate that the Earth is more than 6,000 years old, but clearly genetics doesn't work without a time scale that allows for variation to take place over time. So I do think it is one of those things where it's incredibly hard to wrap one's head around what genes are, because they do seem to, I think what you're sort of suggesting, they exist. It's obviously biology is a hard science, but it's in that funny place where it's not political science soft, but it's also not physics hard. So it's really exists in this interesting place.
And there, I do want to nod to what the genuine concerns are. And some listeners will recognize this, and I, in the interest of time, et cetera, I can't go further into it. But what some of the legitimate concerns of people interested in epigenetics, interested in multiple modes of inheritance, for example, my friend Eva Jablanka, who has written extensively about this, and the so-called extended evolutionary synthesis, for example, Kevin Layla and co-workers, they definitely have legitimate concerns. Genes are very squishy and a very almost a kind of unmoving target, because they're not the same as inheritance. Never mind that inheritance is a moving target, but many things can be inherited, but I do think genes have a special place. I will come down on that side, but I will also completely nod to that there's many other, that not just that there are other forms of inheritance, but that the very way that genes act is itself dependent on these other forms of inheritance. But, you know, this is all discussion. It's all part of, you know, the intellectual project. And I look for, I mean, as long, yeah, if we can keep this planet alive, I look forward to ongoing development. And I do think, going back to your nature nurture question, I think it'd be really interesting to have some bright young person come up with some, okay, now someone has really solved this or something. Maybe you can't, but, you know, These are perennial matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that this, you know, we've obviously that I've only really scratched the surface of what you cover in this book. I think it's a really great example of a you know, a highly interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary work. Clearly, you are you know, as deep as you've gone in genetics and genomics, you've also explored other fields and tried to bring different insights into the study. So I definitely, you know, I look for that in books. That's one of the things that I, you know, there's no one subject that I'm personally interested in. I like to find scholars that really are interested in a variety of subjects, and are able to synthesize different questions and find questions in one field that might be applied to another. So I do commend you for that. Well, Rasmus, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network.